Hello, this is Eric Mack with the third episode of Liberally Correct. The song you just heard there was Superman by R.E.M. from their 1986 album, Life's Rich Pageant. We'll actually be playing another song from that album to close out the show. But in the meantime, we have the second half of the episode we recorded about Bernie Sanders and the effect that he had on the Hillary Clinton campaign. And we ended up recording about 2 hours worth of show, and we want to keep each episode to about 1 hour. So we just decided to split it in half. And so without further ado, here's the second half. Enjoy.
Well, hang on. You're hitting something that's really important that we talk about, but I don't hear it discussed a lot. This was a change election, you heard pundit after pundit after pundit say.
And I should have said, I should have said this at the top, because I was in the San Jose airport last week. Was it last week or whenever that was? And I was talking to you on the phone.
Yes. Yesterday, whatever.
Yeah, and I said the thing that pisses me off most about Bernie Sanders is that he solidified the notion that this was a change election and that we needed a political revolution. He said that every time.
Yeah, we need a revolution was like the climax of his speech.
And for some reason, his supporters don't seem to understand why that was damaging or why that would piss people like us off, who all I wanted was for somebody other than Donald Trump to be president, because, I mean, Trump is a joke.
Yeah, he's I mean, there are a lot of ideas tied into this. I'll hit the one that I think we kind of danced around here. I don't want that many things to change in America. Just because some of them are extremely important, that should change. Doesn't mean I want most things to change. I would like our police force to be a little less terrifying to people who don't look like me, because a functioning police force is about the most important thing we've got going in this country, a functioning fair police force. And so if it's not fair to some of the citizens, and in fact dangerous to some of the citizens, that's a big, big problem. But that's not something just the president can solve. And I know this sounds callous, but in the scheme of the United States, in the scheme of issues that the government has to work out, local, state, national, that's a relatively small fix. Not on a personal level, not if you've actually personally been affected by this massive problem, but we don't have to rewrite the Constitution to make our police forces effective for everybody, right? And there are other major problems in the country that are, again, in the grand scheme, not as major. You don't need a revolution for those things. So when people are saying, I want massive change, I want a few things to change.
We need to stop throwing around the word revolution so irresponsibly. Just because our country had a revolution that ended with the founding of the freest country, we don't know how that's going to change moving forward. But, you know, with the Constitution and the oldest democracy in the world, as I think we are, basically every other revolution that has happened in every other country and in places that were like too savage to really call themselves countries has been bloody. And
you just made the internet hate you. You said savage, but continue.
Whatever.
I mean, you just captured the tone of the podcast.
Violent, right? After you said the other thing. Revolutions are not positive on the whole. I mean, we're the exception that we had this revolution that resulted in freedom. You know, like that is not a natural thing.
No, and the revolution itself was still, you know, incredibly bloody. Like it's not like it was easy. It was a lot of people dying of weird diseases and freezing to death before they even had the opportunity to die slowly from a 18th century bullet. Like, oh man, this really hurts. Can we fix this at the ER that doesn't exist for a long time yet? You know, it was a lot of that. And it was all for, again, a relatively minor change from the method of governance that was already in place.
Yeah. I mean, our legal system is based on common law that we basically inherited from the Brits. John Adams was the lawyer who defended the British troops at the Boston Massacre, who were put on trial after the Boston Massacre.
Right. The essential idea was that what the original Americans, or at least the ones who weren't loyalists, the ones who won and seemed to be in charge of things, what the original Americans seemed to be saying was, we're willing to fight and even die because we believe in the idea of the government that you're presenting to us. We just don't think that's actually what's happening over here. We don't think our government is fair, but you are our continent and specifically our country, mostly English, right? It's administered by England. You are not living up to the ideals that you have given us, so we're going to try and do it ourselves. You know, it's not the sea change. Like we want to change everything about how this thing is governed. we want to wreck it all. They're saying, no, we want it to be fair for us, obviously not for our slaves, but we want it to be fair for us according to the principles that we've already inherited. So even our revolution was not as dramatic, possibly, as some of the things that Trump and Bernie supporters were yelling for.
Yeah, this is a time of obviously rapid change. One such example is these things I read about that are happening on college campuses with the microaggressions and stuff like that that literally did not exist 7 years ago when we were in college. Did not exist. Not at all.
Microaggression didn't exist.
But the safe zones or this kind of stuff. Safe. Like, oh, if you see an Asian,
no, I feel like it's maybe like
make sure you don't ask an Asian student for help on your math homework unless you actually know that student first. That's a real instruction that students got at an orientation.
Oh my God! That's the worst fucking tactical advice. Because I mean, all right, I can see
that
if they're saying
to reinforce stereotypes. I mean, like
right. I can see if they're saying like, don't ask an Asian American student like about their math. You know, their parents were here for a while. They've learned how to be lazy like the rest of you. But man, if the kid's like, yeah, I was born in Taiwan, I'm here now. Ask that motherfucker about math. I can promise you he's better at math than you are.
Yeah. So the rise of social media has made people feel like they want massive change when they're not aware of what massive change really is and that they don't really want massive change.
I don't think they really do. I think people would be scared if they got the things they think they want.
I thought we were going to try to not be condescending.
I'm not saying that because I think that I have discovered some higher truth. I'm saying that because I lived last year in China, which a lot of people like. A lot of white people. Sorry, I'm used to calling the white people over there Westerners, which is weird to everybody else, but I just got used to it. A lot of the Westerners like it. They say, oh man, there's more, you know, there's more buzz here. It's a more exciting time. You know, it's that we can do things here. We can do back home. There's more opportunity. Great for you guys, I guess. But China's, I found it pretty terrifying. There are not protections for the citizens. You can vanish. Someone described the Chinese political system to me once as you can do whatever you want until they kill you, which is sort of how it runs. Like you can make a massive company with limited government oversight. You can pollute the water. You can pollute the air. You can do whatever the fuck you want for any reason. And as long as you know the right people and you bribe the right folks, you can climb really high. But if there's a populist wave against you, then the government might see you as either a threat or an enemy or a scapegoat. Kind of doesn't matter. And you might go away. And sometimes you'll come back. Sometimes you'll come back. After the Shanghai stock market, which is sort of a Fisher Price, my first stock market, crashed in Shanghai, a year later, guys started just disappearing. And a lot of them ended up back. And they're like, oh, I had to leave to help the government on my vacation. Like their statements, their forced statements translated into English were high comedy, except they were really scary. And so China has elements of both of the things that both of our populist candidates this year represented. And when you see both of them in action at the same time, it's terrifying. On the one hand, China has essentially no business oversight. You can do whatever you want for any reason. Well, how is that working out? You can't always see the sun on a theoretically clear day. The lung cancer is pretty big problem.
Yeah. Hard to get any perspective in that kind of situation, literally.
Right. The internet is shut down. I mean, it is really, really closed off. It's getting worse year by year. So if someone's writing an article about, oh, the internet in China is not that bad, check the date on that shit. If it's before 2015, maybe late 2014, they don't know what they're talking about. The government is making a concerted effort to block out information that they don't like that's not from Chinese sources. But at the same time, there's a giant populist current in China. Like, a lot of the people who are disappearing because of the stock market crash seemed, I mean, I'm very untrained in these things. I don't even speak Mandarin. I was like, what is happening here? Was the question I wanted to ask everybody about everything. And I don't think anyone would have really answered, even if I did speak Mandarin. But from what I could gather, you have these guys disappearing in large part because they're perceived to be enemies. Maybe a better example is golf courses were made illegal for party members while I was there. Like, you were no longer allowed to be a member of the Communist Party in China, the government. You were no longer allowed to be a member of the government and go to a golf course. Why? Because it was seen as the place where the rich went to get deals done, you know, where, oh, they're corrupt. It's not that different from this whole idea, oh my God, there were these secret speeches that Hillary gave to these people in power behind the scenes, and we got to stop that somehow. Well, in China, they do that, and it looks funny to us over here. It's not, though. It's very, very terrifying. So China has populism, and it has a little bit of fascism, and it has, like, way out there authoritarian strains of leftism generally. So it's got all of the bad things that we say we want. So when, I'm not trying to be condescending. I'm saying, I mean, I see what it's like, and it chokes the life out of you. It's not a happy world. I've lived in it already, and I'm terrified of it. And I think people don't know what they're asking for. I really don't.
Yeah, so maybe not everybody is familiar with the history of China. There was a recent incident with Trump and Taiwan. Now, if refresh me on the history. Now, when there was the Communist Revolution in China, I believe it was, 1948? And they basically ran the former, who was in government? It was
Chiang Kai-shek. Yes. Was the kind of the grand poobah, pretty rightist guy that they had. He was.
They ran him out to Taiwan, correct?
And then right. Yep. Threw him across the strait.
Taiwan is basically its own. They have their own currency. They have their own government, essentially. And they're essentially two different states. But we have this policy, which on the surface of it looks pretty absurd, this idea that since 1979 we've been referring to China as one China.
At school I was teaching that was actually a rule. You couldn't talk about Taiwan. You could call it a special province, but you could not talk about it as a country.
You were asking me earlier about how socialism has become an acceptable word.
Oh, and that scares you. Yes.
Now that the USSR is no more, it's in a sense coming back, but I guess is with an emphasis on autocracy instead of order. Do I have my ideologies right there? Okay.
I'll find it out later. Yes. We're learning. This is why we're not being condescending. We're learning as we go.
it's interesting. You know, I've been reading this very big book that's very dense as well. So it's 700 pages of dense economic theory. It's called Capital in the 21st Century by Thomas Piketty. I'm by no means an expert on economics. But one of the things that the takeaways of the first few pages that I've read, literally I've read like 20 pages, was that I had never thought about this before, because this whole book is about income and wealth inequality. And I feel like we need to talk about it when we're talking about Bernie. So Marx wrote the Communist Manifesto in 1848, I think is when that was published, if I remember from history class. He came up with this theory and this framework, but the thing that the book points out, not Marx's book, this book I'm reading, points out is that for all these people who came up with economic theories back then, they didn't have any actual data, right? There was no federal income tax, in the US and in other European countries as well, until the early 20th century. So there was data
outside looking in. That's a common problem in economics, I'm told by people who know it far better than I do. It's hard to get data, right? Because you're wondering how do we manage money. You sort of have to see, or resources more generally, you have to wait and see how people do that. And if you're thinking a policy can help, it's kind of hard to test it on a large scale without going all in, right? So it's difficult to get data.
But anyway. Yeah, so It's interesting because we need to sort of talk about, you know, we've had this information revolution that's totally transformed the economy, and people just feel kind of unmoored right now, and just feel like they're adrift at sea or something. And that feeling is real. And I get that that's why Bernie and Trump appealed to these people. But, you know, we had this industrial revolution before that. And there was kind of like how during the information revolution, there was this rapid accumulation of wealth into the hands of the few. But that eventually tapered off over time. Right. And when Marx wrote the Communist Manifesto, he saw this as like this infinite accumulation process, that he thought that unless the working men of all countries, you know, stood up and united and violently overthrew their oppressors at the factories, that they would have no shot at living a good life ever, which turned out not to be the case. And a few decades later, I don't know if it was in Das Kapital or something else that he wrote. I think he later sort of amended his thinking that first surfaced in the Communist Manifesto.
You keep giving us research projects. We're going to have to go back and check if that's exactly right. But okay, well, continue.
After the two world wars, because the government, not only our government, but you know all the Western governments basically needed so much money to fund the freaking wars, that there was such a rapid deterioration of the old social order in terms of the class structure, which no longer really exists in Europe, at least not to the degree that it did 100 years ago. There were these kind of seismic events that more or less even things out. And now we're sort of at this time that once again, we're seeing this rapid accumulation of wealth into the hands of the few. But if history's any indication, we may see things kind of even out in this kind of natural way, like it did before. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, it's that's a far better technical question than I am equipped to answer. I simply don't know enough about.
Well, nobody knows the answer. But
right, but I'm saying I'm not well versed enough in this field to give an answer, to have some way of like back of the napkin modeling of how that might go. I think I know people a little bit, and I think whenever there's a change, people tend to panic. Even if the change is, whenever there's a change, people usually tend to panic. And even if the change is good and people aren't panicking, they tend to assume it will be the way that it is for fucking ever, whatever the thing is. So here's a small example. Whenever you get to a break in a sporting event, you will always have an announcer say like, wow, they're on pace for, if it's a basketball game, they're on a pace for 157 points. They're shooting so well. They're probably not going to make 157 points. They're not on pace for shit. Right? Like, if they score the same number of points they scored that quarter, every quarter, then yes, they'll score 157 points. But that's the idea that that's inevitable because it happened for a very brief period of time at that rate is silly. You saw it too with our recent housing bubble. Again, I'm not equipped to go into the details of why that was a mess, but I think it's pretty inarguable that there was this idea that no matter why it's rising, no matter whether it's rising, how it's rising relative to the levels previous that it rose, housing prices have to keep going up. They can't fall, no matter what. And even though they're rising wildly, they're rising much faster than they ever did before, they must keep rising at this super fast rate. And if they don't, it's a catastrophe that's unimaginable, let alone that they fall. Like, if they stop rising this fast, it's a catastrophe. I think humans are amenable to that sort of insanity. So, your little thing gives me a little bit of hope. It's at least possible that we're freaking out a little too much over something that might not change us as fundamentally as we think.
Yes. So, to get personal and anecdotal here, one thing we haven't gone over yet is the stats. As far as, you know, we've had 81 consecutive months of private sector job growth. I think it's about 15 point something million jobs created during that time. Unemployment is now down to 4.6%. There was 2.9% GDP growth last quarter. So these are certainly real statistics. One thing you kept hearing over and over again, it's like, yeah, but I don't feel that. It's like, okay, yeah, we're not back in the times where we're living in bubbles, like where things were sort of too good to be true.
Expand on that. When was that time?
So during the 2000s, when we had this housing bubble, for instance, okay. And people were buying like second and third homes that they couldn't afford. And I don't know if like people just don't understand that not everybody gets to have an island in their kitchen, but it's just the way it is. And
I think that's fair for some people, but I don't think it's fair for everybody. I think there are a lot of people who didn't necessarily want to have an island in their kitchen, who didn't want, but still felt and feel unmoored in this last election.
Yeah, and a lot of that is because
they're not just white working class. Let's get over that thing. I think a lot of people from everywhere in a lot of different brackets, unless you're actually super rich, unless you're in like the top 1-ish%, maybe we'll give them 10. Unless you're there, you probably had a chance at least of feeling unmoored in the past few years. And I don't think it's because everybody wants massive wealth and garish accoutrements.
Well, sure. I mean, I certainly felt unmoored when I graduated from college. I mean, it was almost comical, except it was like depressing, you know, just how the fact that,
no
one was hiring. It was just like, oh God, you know, you had to go like work for free or work, you know, like a minimum wage job.
Yeah.
Which is not a fun choice to have to make.
Yeah.
The situation is so much different now. There are entire industries that exist now that did not exist at the time.
That's nine-ish.
Yeah, so like the industry I work in now, I mean, I work in digital marketing, and like that really did not exist the way that it does now, certainly when I was in college. So it's just a matter of getting people sort of brought up to speed. That's all it really is. And hopefully we'll be able to do it.
I currently work in the industry of scraping enough together to get by, which has been around as long at least as Bruce Springsteen songs.
Yes.
So that's I don't think that's as much of a growth industry. All right, so we gave ourselves a bunch of research projects. I came out with a scalding hot take that is arguably unfair to a probably nice in-person man in Bernie Sanders, but I don't care because when you set yourself up as a symbol for a movement, you better not be, you know, fucking incompetent as a messiah. you better be able to save people's sins if you get up on a cross for show, is what I feel like with Bernie.
Yeah.
Anyway, save people from their sins. I'm sorry, evangelicals, if I got the syntax wrong. So I guess we started in our first episode wondering what exactly happened in this election. And we don't know, other than to say that a lot of little things. You can't say one giant thing. We're trying to think about some of the things that went wrong from our perspective, or maybe more or less objectively, that may have led to a really, really crazy president and two very populist candidates, we think terrifyingly populist candidates in a short period of time on the national scene. But what's the takeaway for you? our jumping off point for further discussion.
So there was an excellent piece by Andrew Sullivan in the New York Magazine several months ago. It was still while the Republican primary was going on. It's very long, but it was the best piece written during the entire election, I thought. It was called America Has Never Been So Ripe for Tyranny. Basically, it presents the argument that democracies end when they become too democratic. And that's, it sort of takes you through how Plato conceived of democracy back in ancient Greece and what its weaknesses would be. So he hones in on the demagogue, which is why I brought it up. And it brings into startling focus, you know, throughout the history of this country, how we started as much more of a republic, and now we've become far too democratic, I think, in terms of how our government is structured. You know, we had these primaries. You know, why was Bernie Sanders even allowed to compete in the primaries is a question I've been asking myself over and over when he didn't switch parties ever at any time. You don't have an answer to that?
No, it's... I don't know. I think it should have been pretty much, I think it should have been by rule of the Democratic Party, not by national law, because parties are private organizations. But I think it should have been by rule of the party, basically impossible for him to run. But yeah.
You and I are I think, conceive of that much differently than everyone else does, probably because we spend more time thinking and bantering about it. So,
yeah, because we're in a bubble of two as opposed to a bubble of our corner of Facebook.
Yes, but I would encourage everyone to, as I said, it's quite long, but I would encourage everyone to, I'll post the link on the episode page where you might be listening to this. It's on the Liberally Correct website. I think everybody should
read
it.
You're our first listener. You're our very first listener. You get a special prize, which is that we probably just identified you.
Yes.
We think. So, yeah, on air. So, yeah, congratulations.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost entirely about Trump, actually, not Bernie Sanders. But
you think they applied both?
Well, I've actually stolen his line over and over again, where the idea that Bernie Sanders is essentially a refutation of his own argument, right? Where he's going on and on about campaign finance reform, we need to get the money out of politics, and so forth. Yet Bernie almost won the whole thing without a super PAC. And the whole thing being the nomination.
Yeah.
So, if anything, I mean, I think money in politics matters a lot less than it did in years past. Simply because I think TV advertising just doesn't mean jack shit anymore. I mean, talk to Jeb Bush about that one.
Yeah. At least there were some funny, wonderful things that came from this election.
The other thing, this is not funny and wonderful, is just the... how brutal it became on social media to, everybody has the right to their own opinion, but I just kind of winced whenever I saw all these Bernie supporters basically with their slings and arrows. And I get that he was their guy, but
their slings and arrows alleging outrageous fortune.
Yes. Yeah. I get that he was their guy, but I felt like they were taking it really personally. And I tried to tell somebody that the president does not actually, and I will still say this, even though Trump is in charge, the president does not affect your life as much as, you know, obviously the campaigns would have you believe. But that's assuming that the system is healthy and that we don't have a demagogue in office, which we might right now.
If the election of the president materially affects your life, it changes your day-to-day life. It changes the way you interact with the world. That's a problem.
Yeah, that is a very bad thing.
Ideally, thankfully, you wouldn't notice the election that much in your day-to-day.
Yeah, the difference between Romney winning in 2012 or Obama winning in 2012, that would have almost no difference, no impact in terms of your day-to-day life.
Yeah,
I would have
for many Americans.
If you're in the military, if you're, you know, there are some exceptions, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you're in the military, and again, going back to if you believe that symbols have any power, he may have simply by his own office, not by himself, but by his own branch of government, made it more symbolically acceptable to be of a different group than you normally see in power. So maybe over time it makes a difference. But yeah, your day-to-day for most Americans, and probably not going to change that much.
And that's because we have such a strong system and such an awesome system where we can go about our day-to-day lives and leave the matters of actually running our country to other people that we elect. Every once in a while, we just show up at the ballot box and
cast a vote.
That's
oh, really?
And then yeah. And then they work for us. That's a pretty great system. You know, when you really get down to it, we should be thankful that we have that system. I don't agree that we need to just blow everything up. I started out this podcast, which was now like an hour and a half ago, saying that like I have a different view of parties now, largely because of Trump and Sanders, because I didn't realize how important it was we had these parties in place to basically prevent demagogues from running through the finish line. And that I'd always sort of looked at parties as sort of like, well, that's where people who think this way, that's where all they reside. I like to think I don't belong to anything. So I sort of value my independence, you know, that kind of thing. But really, diversity within parties only kind of makes them stronger, I think. So, you know, in order...
Can we pivot to all is not lost? Yeah.
All is not lost. Now, we have 22 million people who work for the government at the local, state, and national levels. So combined, if you add all those people up, all the people at the post office, all the people... If you add President Obama, President Trump, Add all those people up. That's all the people at the airport, at the TSA. All those people, that's 22 million people. That's one in every 14 and a half Americans. And that includes kids and senior citizens who do not work, right? That is crazy.
Yeah, fuck them. Get a job. Sorry, is it too soon?
But
when's that become our national
slogan again? Not all of those people are holding elective office and are doing so on behalf of a party. But actually having parties prevents people from coming in and essentially altering how the government works. They may come in and alter what the government does, but not how it works. And that's important. That's what I wanted to end on.
The thing I wanted to end with is I think, I'm not sure if it ties neatly, but I think they're conceptually related. I wanted to say, if you're worried about this change in the country, if you don't like the idea of a President Trump, if you think that warts and all, the Obama administration was a good thing, the votes are there. Like, the country, it wasn't a mirage. The country is generally socially much more liberal than it was 8 years ago. There are more people from exit polling saying, identifying as liberal than there have ever been.
Yes.
We're tilting left.
But 45% of the electorate did not vote.
Yeah, and 45% of the electorate did not vote. The votes are there. And also, you got a lot of people who voted for Trump, who, and this is very important as we're winging around hot takes left and right, like fuck Bernie Sanders, who, again, is probably a nice man. Still fuck him, but probably a nice man. When we're saying shit like that, you know, you can get lost in the weeds and forget that, yeah, not everybody who voted for Trump was some kind of crazy racist. A lot of them were people who were going about their lives, did not follow this that closely, super fucking smart, and all they really thought about was, oh, my insurance premiums went up a lot. I voted Republican in the past. This guy's a little gruffer than usual.
Many of them voted for Obama in the past.
Yeah, or voted for Obama in the past. And they're like, yeah, I really don't like her. She seems shady. I'm just used to it. She seems like she always wants to hide something, even if there's nothing there. It seems like she always wants to hide something. I don't really like her. And she's trying to raise my taxes. Why should I fucking vote for that? You know, not everybody who voted that way will always vote for that party. And not everyone who voted that way is like evil or even necessarily that angry at you if you identify as a lefty. So I think there's hope. I think the votes are there for at least a centrist country, relatively speaking, and certainly for a slightly more liberal country than it's been previously. So it's there. You got to vote. We all have to vote, which is something that I didn't do until this.
Yes, and we all have to get more involved with the two parties. I mean, we need sane people in the Republican Party too. Obviously, we are leaning more toward the Democratic Party, but we need sane people everywhere. So,
and if anything, we need more than two parties, sane people in more than two parties, if possible, if that can happen.
Yeah, I mean, what I want is I want two candidates who, like, I want to actually feel like I have a choice, and like a hard choice, that in a good way, that like I, like, wow, I actually have two people I would be happy with as president, and I want to pick the best one.
Yeah,
that is never what happens. Now, in the case of Obama, I actually liked Obama as a person, and I sympathize with his idealist tendencies. I think he's smart. So I think you could actually argue that he was maybe the first populist president, since he doesn't really fit into the Democratic mold. He actually was kind of the original Bernie Sanders, only he sort of had more meat on the bones.
Interesting. Wow. Well, maybe we can talk about that later.
Yeah. Okay. We need to close on this, because I just realized we haven't talked about it. Yes or no, do you think Bernie Sanders would have won the general?
Ooh. Do I think Bernie Sanders would have won? It's easy to throw out some guess based on nothing, because there's no data on that.
Yeah, Let me go with a little bit of background. He was never portrayed in a negative light by Hillary or by the Republicans, because nobody took him seriously.
He is never challenged. I think he would have been very unpopular. But one thing we really haven't talked about, both candidates were massively unpopular.
Yes.
Like, the guy who just won has insane unfavorability ratings. But so did Hillary. It wouldn't have even been a race if there were a, like, you know, not crazy Republican running. I don't think any of those ran even in the primaries. I'm not even sure if they make
or a likable Democrat that wasn't Bernie Sanders. Bernie wasn't a Democrat, actually. Still
right.
Isn't.
I think it would have been similar, I think, for reasons of the gut more than the head, he probably would have kept, I think he would have kept Michigan. Don't know about Wisconsin. Yeah. Think he would have lost Ohio. Definitely would have lost Florida. He's Jewish. He is Jewish.
And he's old.
He's old and Jewish. It would have been tight. I think he would have gained on her, almost certainly, because I think he would have taken Michigan at least. I can't say for certain. I mean, no one can, but
I think he would have done worse in the popular vote for sure.
Definitely done worse in the popular vote. I'll go with that. Definitely done worse in the popular vote, but I think he would have.
I don't know. I mean, who would you have voted for? I mean, that's the problem I have. Everybody is saying, not everybody, but all the Bernie supporters are saying, like, oh, Bernie would have crushed this shit, no problem. But I would have, on principle, because I hate the idea of protest voting when you're essentially throwing your vote away. But on the one hand, if it was this, then that would have been voting for there were two demagogues on the ballot. And
I think one demagogue was much more, he was crueler than the other in this hypothetical election. And the thing that I dislike about Bernie Sanders would have actually made him a little more stable, which is that he says the same thing all the time, regardless of context. And he confuses an inability to compromise on anything ever with nobility and really forget a skill for governance. He confuses it with like an aptitude for governance. I never change my mind. I'm going to be good at organizing a massive enterprise with a lot of people who don't think the way I do. That's my qualification, is I never fucking changed my mind. But that would have at least made him predictable. One of the worst things about Trump is on the foreign policy side, where he's completely unpredictable. That's one of the ways that it could actually materially affect us if we end up into a real or proxy war with any of these other regional or great powers we're dealing with. If that happens, then your life could change, because we will all have less stuff and the world will be scarier and you will not have as many international flights everywhere. I think the odds of that sort of scenario would be lower with Bernie Sanders. So only because Trump is on the other side, I would have had to vote for Bernie. I would have had to do it only because Trump's
it would have been for the same reason. I was talking to my sister-in-law and about the election afterwards, and she voted for Gary Johnson, and
so did my brother.
Yeah, so she said that, and I posed that same hypothetical, just kind of jokingly. I said, "Well, what if it were Bernie Sanders?" And she said, "Oh no, I would have voted for Trump to keep Bernie out."
Yeah, I think there's more of that out there than people think.
Yes, because Bernie was never considered. He was never attacked ever,
right?
I mean,
so
he was,
like,
I mean, like, in the Republican debates and stuff. I mean, he was just laughed at. I mean, he was ridiculed basically.
Right. I think a lot of people would have considered him a loony. I think because of Trump's
it comes back to the use of the word socialism. People are just
so
not,
freely and liberally
not going to. That's just not going to fly with the majority of the electorate. I mean, it's just not.
For good reason. I mean, for good reason. There are concepts of you can't. We're gonna go back into a rabbit hole if we do that. Just I'll say for good reason. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't mind that the electorate doesn't like the word socialism. That doesn't make me think less of the electorate, broadly speaking. I think he would have eked it out, perhaps even losing the popular vote, because I think he would have taken those 110,000 votes separating Clinton from the presidency in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. Those 110,000 votes, I think, would have swung to him, I think.
Yeah, maybe Iowa.
Maybe. I still think I think it's too red. Maybe. Florida, I think, would have gone against him. I really do. They like crazies, but Florida's like Trump. I mean, I'm from Florida originally, and Florida's like Donald Trump. They like people like that. Oh my God, he's loud and he steals from people so that he can spend it lavishly on himself. in the crudest ways, like in the rudest and loudest ways. That's, you know, that's sort of what Miami is. Pretty fun to visit. It's not a great place to live for the soul, I feel like. So I think Florida was going for Trump regardless.
Yeah, and South Florida in particular, I mean, it's a lot of just New York transplants. So, and there's just kind of that same attitude.
Yeah, although, granted, we say that, except that New York went like overwhelmingly for Hillary. So who knows? You can't say for sure. I think the important thing to note is that the idea that it would have been a cakewalk is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Sanders would have been very unliked if brought to true national scrutiny. Very disliked.
Yeah, and if he had actually won, then what? Because there's no... because he would have had to basically let down all his supporters, because he wouldn't have been able to pass anything that he wanted to do. Zero.
Yeah. Yeah, and like if he won, I can still see
the Republicans
holding the Senate.
Yeah, they would have dug in like, I mean, Obama would have looked like nothing compared to Bernie Sanders in terms of an enemy.
Yeah. Because Obama wanted to compromise.
They've been calling Obama a socialist for 8 years, and then an actual socialist, you know, self-described socialist, you know, taking office. I don't think so. I mean, there was no hope there. So I'd rather roll the dice with Hillary and lose than roll the dice with Bernie. Well, here's my long-term prognosis. Is I think some of this isn't going to even be Trump's fault. I mean, I think about, you know, recessions happen every 7 to 8 years, and I think we're just kind of due for a downturn. I mean, 81 consecutive months of private sector job growth. I mean, that's gotta end at some point.
Well, I mean, some of it's gotta be fake, essentially. I don't mean that people are making up jobs and feeding them to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. I mean that some of the financial products that made so many people so spectacularly wealthy for a short period of time, I'd be stunned if they're not at play in some way still. Like I can't imagine that you made an enormous amount of money on messing around with collateralized debt obligations in, you know, 2004, the thing tanks, and you're like, oh, I'll never do that again, especially if you didn't personally tank.
Right.
Like, I can't imagine that there's not a similarly sneaky suite of products and salesmanship at play in some sector of the economy that I'm not involved in, so I don't really know about. But it wouldn't stun me if there's another essentially con in the offing.
I mean, it's just bound to happen. I mean, we're at unemployment's at 4.6% right now. I mean, that has to go up. I mean, it can't really go down any farther. So it's not really a question of, I mean, I'm not going to blame Trump for that when the economy starts to go south.
No, that's the one thing that won't be his fault in this coming 4 years.
And in the sense that, I mean, it's always like this to some degree that, you know, there are a lot of events that are just outside. I mean, we like to sort of spin this narrative that like, oh, the president, like he has control of everything. But there are a lot of these events that are sort of that the president just has to kind of react to.
Yep.
And that's going to be, and we're going to have to see how Trump reacts to certain events. And that's going to be one of them. And I'm going to be a keen observer to see just how he and his team handle the news, I suppose.
Oh, I feel like a resignation is not impossible. People are talking impeachment. Like, he's not going to like the job. Fundamentally, he's going to hate the job. The only thing that's making him actually stand around until he's sworn in is that he can't admit that he's wrong. Like, I think if you told him, oh my God, that was amazing, the only thing that would make us love you more is if you handed it off to name whatever politician as a gesture of like goodwill and then stayed on as our champion. Like, if you concocted some fantasy where he rides off in the sunset without having to do president work, or if you like named him emperor and then let him do Donald Trumpy things and then made other people actually be president, I think he'd love that. I think he's kind of trying to do that right now. I can see maybe impeachment hearings going against him, and before things are concluded, him saying, "Ah, fuck it," and walking. I can see that.
Well,
happening.
There's this there's this carrier deal, which, and this is going to lead into the next episode we record perfectly. So this is a good time to bring it up because we're about to call it quits on this episode. But there's this carrier deal where, you know, I first saw the headline. And I was like, oh my God, Trump, through sheer force of will and intimidation, basically got these jobs to stay. Oh my God, like, holy shit. How is this possible? And then I sort of started reading the details, and okay, so it's not 1,000 jobs actually. And by the way, it was going to be 2,100 jobs, but they decided to have 1,000 stay. But actually, that's going to be 700 jobs. So it's really only a third of. There's still 1,400 jobs essentially that are going to go to Mexico anyway. And
so, in other words, Carrier got to look good. Trump got to look good. Pence, who must have a little leverage still in Indiana, gets to look good. And
the taxpayers do not, because the state of Indiana is going to be, it's this brand new concept called the subsidy. Yes.
Oh my God. Tell me more.
The state of Indiana is forking over $7 million in tax deductions to Carrier to keep 700 jobs there. So $10,000 per worker is going to be paid on behalf of the taxpayers.
$10,000 per worker?
Yes, over the course of 10 years. Yes.
Wow.
So $1,000 a year plus other perks. So, but it pisses me off because I want to get this last point out, and then, because this is a good transition to the next episode. The media, they present all the sides of it, including the part about it's just a subsidy. Like, so what? You know, they're saying like, oh, this is a huge win for Trump because the optics are just so amazing for him. This is a huge PR win because everybody is seeing that he's making this deal and keeping jobs. I'm like, not if you did your fucking job and actually told us exactly what was going on, and that it was really the Indiana taxpayers who are forking over money for this to keep these jobs here.
If you didn't lead with the headline, amazing PR win, maybe people wouldn't think it was an amazing PR win.
Yes. So
it's possible.
So I want to wrap up this episode because we have just talked for 2 hours about Bernie Sanders, and we're going to have to divide this episode in half. When we thought that after the first hour, the first episode, we were dividing that one in half, and that we were only going to be spending another hour total on Bernie Sanders.
We like to talk a lot. We really hope that somebody likes to listen to this. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So wrap
this
is going
to be a really long pilot, by the way. The studio better be happy with this. So, what do you want to end on here? Because I want to transition to the media. It's definitely I think Bernie and Trump would not have been possible without social media, and particularly Bernie was actually able to kind of stay in the game as long as possible because he had this rabid social following. Then that never went away until the end. And it's like, you sort of don't need...
Still hasn't gone away.
Yeah, I mean, you sort of don't need money if you just have this social following. If you have a Twitter following, like Trump did as well.
Yeah. I guess what I want to end on is an earnest plea to the, let's say, 1 to 4 people who might listen to this in his lifetime online. And that's... Not only are the votes there for... I think a better kind of country, which doesn't even mean a more radically liberal country, just means a more centrist country than the one we're getting. Not only are the votes there for a little bit of sanity if we actually put in the time to do it, but we, for the people that I've probably horribly angered, may or may not ever hear this, on Bernie's side, we can't go on like this. We government is not about saying your spiel, giving a speech for eternity into the abyss. Government is not about getting angry and having your passion get everybody to think the same way you do. Government is very detailed work if done properly. Much of it should be dispassionate. A lot of it's very, very boring. Some big changes in a few people's lives in the short term and a lot of people's lives in the long term may rest on a pretty arcane policy discussion that most of us won't really get, either because, you know, we're living our lives or because we're just not that interested in it, whatever it might be. Getting a sane country involves voting repeatedly, and I'm very, very guilty of this. This was my first election. I'm as guilty of this as anybody. You don't wait until you see something shiny that you like. you have to repeatedly vote for mostly boring people, often with ego issues, over and over to make minor changes in the hopes that things stay mostly the same so that you and your kids can have a good life. That's it. That's all it is. And I think if we just accept that it's not going to be that dramatic and that government shouldn't change most of our lives, I think it'll be easier going forward. And maybe we can get some more reasonable people to run for office in the first place.
Yes. And part of the issue is that we have this political media industrial complex that turns this whole thing into a year and a half long horse race. But we'll get into that in the next episode. What I want to end this on, to continue from your point, which we never quite said in these words, but the phrase that compromise is government. Like this,
yeah.
The strength of our country is actually our ability to compromise. So the fact that the Bernie Sanders was basically selling this "I'd never compromise" bullshit. You know, like we fought a civil war because we could no longer compromise. Like we ran out, like we had the compromise of 1850. You know, the Three-Fifths Compromise. I need to go back to history class. But you know, in the 1840s and 50s, you know, we had this slew of compromises to try to avert a civil war. And then we couldn't do it any longer. And we fought a civil war and we had an assassinated president, our greatest president of all time. And we had essentially a second founding. That we need to avoid that process. And if it means putting away our Twitter feeds and Facebook pages, we might want to consider doing that.
Because
actually screaming online does not do jack shit. Voting matters, and maybe actually getting involved, you know, on the local level,
which is boring.
Which is so boring that nobody ever does it. Yes,
which is watching a bunch of people, often you know, pretty small-minded people, like people all about their little district, their little slice of the world, arguing with each other about small things. I mean, that's what local government is. We need to listen to a few of these things, give a tiny bit of our time. Some of us maybe will give more, but give a tiny bit of our time to listen to these on local stations you didn't know you had. Listen to these tiny debates. Get a rough feel. The internet makes it easy. Get a rough feel for what people in your immediate neighborhood are saying about what they want to do with your immediate governance. And then vote every time. And again, I've been as guilty of this as anybody. I see the dangers now. I see the problem.
All right. Well, that will pretty much do it for this episode. Brett, it's been a pleasure. And yeah, sorry, Bernie. You
fuck Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, he's going to play a pretty pivotal role moving forward. But it'll be interesting to see sort of what his role in the party that he's not technically a member of yet helped shape the platform of how that's going to work. But
my first test of my compromise doctrine will be, I say fuck Bernie Sanders, and also, well, I gotta follow his lead.
Yes.
Because I have to vote Democrat. There's my first compromise. I really don't like this guy. I think he's dangerous. Also, I've got to root for him and abide, at least in some way, by his decisions.
Yeah. So we will see you in the next episode where we will tackle the media in great detail. There's a lot to talk about. It's the last of the major topics we wanted to discuss coming out of the gate here before we move on to guests.
We hope you're excited by our vague list of upcoming topics.
Yeah, we will.
Media is definitely happening.
Keep an eye out for the next episode, and we'll see you soon. Break! That's the end of episode number 3 of Liberally Correct, and I wanted to thank you for listening. And check out episode number 4 when we eventually record that, which will be soon. And to close things out here, I wanted to play another song from the REM album Life's Rich Pageant. This is called Begin the Begin. Still, I, the king.
with the sound.